Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' The Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to finish up Section 5 of James Mason's Siege, which is compiled and composed of newsletters that he published from 1980 to 1986. And Chapter 5 is on the system. We've already done two segments on it. We pick up with 524 until the end, which is about 10 more segments. So, 5.24, send in the clowns. And he had concluded 523, talking about how he used to go and speak at a local, I think it was a high school, did that for a number of years, but he had stopped doing that. And he listed his reasons in that segment. So 5.24, send in the clowns. Only one thing did come out of those speaking appearances, which numbered about 14, spread over the last 7 years, he would do in the spring and fall. Approximately 3.5 years ago, at the conclusion of a typical address, and as part of the usual group of those who'd come to discuss some topic one-on-one with me at the podium, an individual introduced himself and began with statements of praise for what I had to say, expressions of fear that it might be true, and the amazement that I was willing and able to stand there and successfully exchange barbs with the few hecklers who made themselves known from time to time. Slight of stature, racially good, well-spoken, and presenting a professional social image, he insisted on giving me his name and address in hopes of getting together at a later time in order to discuss matters at greater length and in greater detail. Not just one or two things, but everything about this guy told me he wasn't for real. He had, quote, agent written across his forehead. I readily agreed to meet. True to his word, the contacts were made and a long series of meetings began, which didn't change in their essence for the next 2 years. He had it all well covered. He had been in the audience that day, as, though a daughter who attended that school, he heard I was going to appear. Or as, through a daughter who attended that school, he heard I was going to appear. He was a ready-made, quote, sympathizer, and had all the right come-ons and comebacks. He was a few years younger than myself, and from experience several years before in the same county of Ohio, I guess they knew that they could never get me to fall for a racial lowlife. Trouble was that, immediately after I cut off dealings with and practices of the normal right wing, I commented to one associate that, henceforth, for the authorities to send in one of their own clowns, they'd be compelled to do so accompanied by a full brass band, for there could no longer be any hope of sneaking someone in. So he's gotten sick of the right-wing mass strategy. He's going to do stuff on his own, and so he knows the feds are aware of who he is, so he's aware that anyone coming is going to be seen miles away, essentially, due to his new position. Again, he's in Chillicothe, Ohio. This was a circumstance handled in a manner that is not advisable for most to try. Though only one person was laboring under any illusions, him thinking that he was taking me in, he was damn good at what he was doing, and no doubt could have made a terrific mileage had he hit a regular group of the movement. He was the dream of the mass strategy set, and he was the kind which Commander Rockwell spoke when he would taunt the Washington, D.C. office of the FBI to please send him more of. The free dinners, free gifts, cash contributions, and subscriptions, etc., that I received over the three-year period, when added up, would have to be formidable. It's only worth mentioning in passing now because they weren't able to hang me on anything. Otherwise, I assure you, none of it is worth it. Very basically, I wanted to find out what they wanted to know. Plus, the material support didn't hurt. It was sort of a tightrope walk. Since you just don't get genuine support like this, the question becomes, What makes a good agent? He looks and acts good. He talks a good line. He's ready with the cash. He's ready with the goods and services. He wants to help, to be involved. I guess at this point, we part company with the credibility building phase and get down to the infiltration proper. He pretended to know a little, but he wanted to know a lot. He really wanted to know about the Manson connection. After a few months and at one meeting at a restaurant where I had a friend with me, he inquired of my friend after I had excused myself from the table, what types of weapons did I have? And one other unique thing. As part of both building credibility and prying their way in, good agents will go to work on their intended victim's vanity and ego. I feel very honored because this guy was a licensed pilot and took me on many a pleasing junket into the wild blue. All this just to impress little old me. Maybe he or his superiors began to get the feeling I was a dead end as I was using up somebody's money and time and supplying only what could be gleaned from reading movement publications. At any rate, he disappeared for a period of months. I never attempted contacting him, just as I had never bothered to check into him or any of his covers. Why bother? I was sure, in my own mind, he was bogus and hostile and played things accordingly at all times. I could effectively do no more at that stage. Details were details, and my resources uncovering such things were not even at par with their ability to conceal them. So he's pretty sure he's got a read on this guy. Then, of course, came the beginning of 1985 and the explosion onto the national scene of the order. This transformed more than one thing in the affairs of the movement. Suddenly he was back on the telephone, wanting to get together again. He had been away in Florida, he said. This time he wanted to get to know the different groups and, through me, the use of airplanes, travel, and meet the various leaders. At the same time, he began propositioning me with money-making schemes involving the planes that centered around hopping state lines for the purpose of evading taxes. Finally, in an effort to get something all set up, he arranged a meeting between me and the man he was supposedly going to fly these runs for. Basically, I was greeted by an older, sharper version of himself at the runway, piloting a plane twice the size of anything he had ever brought himself before. The two of them flew me several hundred miles away for a quick lunch. At the lunch, they kept talking taxes and ways to get out of them. They had obviously already despaired of ever succoring me on illegal weapons or acts of violence. As a prelude to this, however, their scenario was to include my helping the first agent in his bid to win points and secure this lucrative flying job with his prospective boss, Agent 2. He told me to give him a big build-up to the new guy when he was away from us at one point. Like clockwork, the first agent excused himself from the table, leaving me and the second one alone. And, like clockwork, the second agent pointedly asked me how well I knew Agent Number 1. The truth was that I had known him on and off for 3 years. One would surely think that one person gets to know, or thinks he gets to know, another person in a period of time like that. My pointed response was, not very well at all. After a pleasant and uneventful return flight home, we parted company with smiles, handshakes, and waves. I haven't seen or heard from either one of them ever since. My own opinion? As I said, that final meeting was clearly intended to be either the firm start or the final finish of something. And who was the older man who piloted the twin-engine cabin cruiser in the sky? The direct superior of the younger man, Agent Number 1. He was there to size me up for himself after the former's 3-year job of groundwork. And my answer to his question was all he needed to hear. in order to know what his young friend didn't see. That was Volume 15, Number 4, April 1986. 5.25, Ski-rude. Screwed. While still in the sky with this pair, my thoughts were of a situation in transformation. It was now serious. While chuckling to myself over the very thought of a spectacle such as this one, I knew from experience that one plant can be no more than an informant, while two or more can be, and usually are, a setup. So one plant's an informant, two or more are a setup. I knew, and finally acknowledged to myself, that I was going to have to do what I had been toying with ever since the first contact by the younger agent. I would have to check them out. Having no concrete reason to believe they wouldn't attempt to proceed with their plan involving me, I telephoned an attorney whose acquaintance I had made while helping with the defense of an entrapment case in 1979. The men concerned had been infiltrated, set up, and entrapped first, and significantly enough for a period of 3 years, by one agent, and then, at the critical stage, by several, and had been convicted in federal court and served 4 years in a federal penitentiary for having done nothing. This particular attorney, the sharpest and best I've witnessed, Perry Mason included, I knew had been deeply chagrined at having lost the case to the prosecution despite overwhelming evidence that the whole thing had been conceived, engineered, and instrumented by police agents, and despite a brilliant defense. Furthermore, it had all happened just before Abscam, and certainly before DeLorean. Had it happened afterward, as I told him when I recontacted him, he'd most surely have won. Aside from all this, the man had impressed me with the speed and thoroughness with which he had dug out the background on the prime agent involved in this entrapment case. From absolute zero to a complete sketch in about 20 minutes from the time we first met, and I supplied him with the agent's cover name and a photograph of him. It seems this attorney had been an FBI man before taking up law and, since our last meeting, had served as a municipal judge. And he agreed to help me now, without hesitation and without fee. What he found out was that the first agent was a licensed PI, a private investigator in the state of Ohio, including the name of the agency for which he worked, plus the fact that he had turned state's witness with information he'd been paid by the defense to collect in a rape case the year before. And so my suspicions were confirmed. The attorney also felt the situation serious enough to warrant hiring a private investigator of our own to learn why I was being watched and exactly who was footing the bill, as this was a private business. The attorney's services were free, but to retain an investigator would cost $500 going in. At that point, with this man knowing my story, I felt my ass was sufficiently covered, even if the agents made a reappearance. Naturally, I wanted to know what was behind all this. If I were to scrimp and save, I might have been able to come up with the $500, but I had two afterthoughts. First, to tell the agents to go to hell and forget the whole thing, now that the joke was over. Second, since this affair did involve the movement, and I was only in a cockpit position, I'd go to the movement and request help in turning around on the system for a change. This final afterthought I decided was the best course by far. Right away I ruled out a general appeal because I have seen from experience just how dismally those turn out, and this was far too important to trifle around with. So I settled upon a handful of movement leaders upon whom to appeal. Significantly, the same group I had been watching over the years and placing increasingly high hopes in, as well as the same ones that the agent had expressed the greatest interest in my helping him get close to. The system and I seem to be noticing the same things, and certainly, by all this, these men had a very real and vested interest in cooperating with me in order to not only protect all of us, but score a strong victory for the movement, as well in a great show of working unity. Split amongst the group, the dollar amount called for was practically insignificant. Remember, these were considered by both the system and myself as the best, those most effective, most dangerous to the system, and therefore most worth watching. And the response to the urgent appeal that went out via certified mail with copies of the attorney's letter attached? Zero. After a time, I received one polite response from one of these men, and that was all. The rest chose to ignore it completely. And while this was in progress, they were all lamenting the fatal damage done to the order by these very same types of infiltrators. Agents who were in operation at the same time as Thomas Martinez, the man who informed on and later testified in court against the members of the order, etc., who were working their way into different movement circles, the same types as had sent who knows how many others to prison or to death, and who were still around and active after the climax with the order, doing their level best to try to move in and wreck what was left of the movement, lest it might produce still other organized revolutionaries. In essence, I had asked the movement the same identical kind of question as that senior agent had asked of me at that final luncheon date. The answer was given, and in no unmistakable terms. I was disgusted, but not surprised. I had known all along that when you are in any kind of trouble, as far as the movement is concerned, you are just plain skeered. In 20 years of all kinds of trouble, I had known better than to call upon the movement for help. This time it could have been the worst jam I was ever in. It had all of those potentialities. But instead of falling into a system trap, I worked things to where it could have been a movement trap for the system. Instead of crying for help out of a mess, I was inviting aid in prosecuting an offensive-type operation. And you can be sure, by the result, that I have been thanking what gods there may be ever since that it had not been a case of my ass in the sling. Just be sure it never happens to you. Volume 15, Number 4, April 1986. 526. 5.26. Thanks, but no thanks. Again. As I stated a few segments back, this year saw the first time I have felt compelled to decline offers to promote movement exposure. Last month I mentioned the cancellation of the speaking engagements. This month it is about a direct approach by the press here locally for an interview. The last time any dealing with the press here was had, it was on account of a prominent movement personality known internationally. Since we were all publicity hounds then, by both bent and profession, I telephoned the local paper's newsroom and informed them of his presence in town. So what? Was the response I received. This being a small town anyway, and my being a person who doesn't forget, when John Hinckley shot Reagan and this paper had wire service photos of an individual purported to be Hinckley but who was not, I didn't bother saying a word about it. Last year, Universal Order, Chillicothe, and my own name appeared in nationally circulated periodicals. The local paper, as I later found out, didn't catch any of it, and I, for my part, wasn't interested in bringing it to their attention. Then suddenly, in January, I was forcefully approached, later wined and dined, in the hopes that I would not only grant this paper an interview, but a photo spread as well. I must confess the old temptation arose, and at one brief point I had made up my mind to do it. The evening I had bumped into an enemy of mine in a downtown drugstore and had thought that would be a novel way to remind him and the rest just who they had made an enemy of. But within 24 hours I had thought better of it. Several personal pleadings from those closest to me, plus my own better judgment, finally caused me to rule it out entirely. As for my enemies, those distant as well as the more current, I had already successfully defeated them at the time of the challenge and had permanently confounded their plans. I am a man of revenge, but I am also a realist. I will not sacrifice myself for the sake of any punitive measure, large or small. As Manson would pointedly ask, "Are you ready to die? Because if you aren't ready to die over this or that particular issue, then you'd best let it ride." Besides, this would have been merely blowing smoke, serving a warning. And, serious as I am, I believe in doing neither. Let's face it, that story, any such story, would have come out just like a veiled threat to these stupid yokels who understand nothing. Today I am in better shape and position and have more ins than I ever had as a mass strategy act. The story would have blown most of all that, and for what? So these fools would have something to gaggle on about for the next 10 years or so? I say 10 years because to this day people tell me tales from when, in 1974, quote, "the Nazis had a booth at the county fair." They don't know me as the person who organized the first openly Nazi county fair booth. They could scarcely conceal their upset with me in their publisher's office when I broke it to them that I would have to decline their generous offer. About the best they could do to try and spite me was to coolly inform me that should anything involving me come across the wire services, there'd be nothing I could do to prevent them from printing it in their paper. True enough, as far as it went, but then they had missed everything that had come across the wire. And lately I follow my new policy of run silent, run deep. Unless I'm grossly mistaken, they've missed their opportunity. Then finally there is a quick, fleeting consideration. It had only been a matter of a few weeks since I had, for all practical purposes, shut the door on the spy game someone or some agency had been running on me for a 3-year period. The timing and the newspaper's insistence were both a bit too, quote, high for me, but take it or leave it as you will. Volume 15, number 5, May 1986, that was. 5.27, Spooksville. The first time as a kid anyone samples boxing in the ring, one of the first things his instructor will tell him is, expect to be hit. And not lightly tapped either, but clobbered as hard as his opponent, just as determined not to be hit and to win the match himself, can manage. But hit he will be until he masters the art gradually. If he is too faint-hearted, he will flee the ring at once. If he is too inept, he will get his brains beaten out. But if he is a healthy, normal specimen, then Nietzsche's maxim will prevail in his case. He will feel the blows when they land, but he will learn that blows are to be warded off. He will learn not to lead with his chin, just to impress anyone that he can take it. Above all, he will master himself and not allow himself to be spooked, either by his opponent or by the image of what might happen. For to allow oneself to be spooked is to concede defeat before the real fight begins. When antagonism leads to conflict, and most especially when one antagonist is an old, well-established, deeply entrenched system, while the other is a young, bantamweight revolutionary movement, then the fight is going to be heavily one-sided throughout much of its duration. The enormous body fat of the system will absorb the brunt of our best blows, while any backhanded swat from the system, if allowed to connect, can send us reeling off our feet. One thing, however, the blows we have felt in the past are truly about as hard as can be felt, for the system's attacks, for the most part, have been and can be expected to remain on the individual, personal level. To attack us as a movement, as a party, would be a great strategic mistake for the system, and they well know it. It would provide for us the mass forum we could never manage for ourselves. It would make us a public cause. It would also be a strong unifying factor, and that they cannot afford. They will continue to keep it to a, quote, criminal level, attacking us singly or in the smallest groups in order to make the pickings easy and to prevent a political spectacle. This being the case, then, it is up to the movement to better learn how, when, and where to aim and deliver its blows. We've been leading with our chins for the past 20-odd years, and it's time to stop. The fall taken for a federal conspiracy charge without basis would be no harder than one with a basis to it. A trip to the penitentiary for the deaths of a half-dozen racial enemies would be no longer or worse than a trip for the deaths of hundreds. The consequences for the wounding of one or several system bureaucrats are about the same as they would be for killing them. However, none of this is the actual point. The first time something goes wrong, you can blame others. A second time it goes wrong, you can only blame yourself. Never make the same mistake twice. If you can help it, never make it once. The rule is that once burned, twice shy. It only means keeping your hand out of the fire, not staying clear of the kitchen. The system wants and depends upon intimidation. They count on fear and division to keep an increasingly alienated and sullen population subjected. Don't get spooked. Get sharp. Rise and fight again with the experience you have gained. My greatest experience as a young novice in the ring with the system landed me in the Cincinnati workhouse for 6 months in the early 1970s. By contrast, my, quote, blow took less than 60 seconds. However, today's course was set in that cell block. I recall walking along that block among a population half black and thinking to myself, what a setting this was for one to end up a political effort. But the fact was that the previous effort had led there, with no result, and, upon release, could lead there again, also without result. And I recall in the next moment, looking upward those six stories of prison cells, in that dungeon dating from the Civil War, toward the roof of the place where the pigeons flew about freely, and knowing right then that when I walked out of there the following year, I'd be set on a new course. Hand in hand with that larger experience were many smaller ones of a day-to-day nature. Perhaps the most indicative of these was the comment made by one black prisoner as our group was being herded aside for a surprise shakedown. Don't they know that this only forces us to become sharper? For most in the traditional racialist right, the feeling that the police have eyes in the back of their heads must be gotten over. It is true that we today have what Tomasi correctly saw as a, quote, Big Brother electronic surveillance society, but I would maintain that it's still not omniscient or omnipresent, and the technology even has the effect of making Big Brother's pigs spoiled and lazy. Big Brother has, up till now, and probably always shall, depended upon, number one, our own stupid goof-ups, and number two, Uncle Tom's and other species of babbling idiots in society, for the effectiveness of his investigations, detections, arrests, and prosecutions. And these are some very age-old tactics and can be combated in equally simple, age-old ways. Determination plus guts plus smarts equals an effective and successful revolutionary movement. That was Volume 11, Number 8, August 1982. remember this chapter is named The System. 5.28, Biting the Bullet. I've just stated that your first time up against the Big Brother system, just like a brand new boxer's first time in the ring, isn't likely at all to be a winner. In fact, the first several times, one is likely to fall flat. We recalled that it was Nietzsche who said, "That which does not destroy me makes me stronger," but we have to include the unspoken proviso that says, obviously, if you take a hard enough blow from the system to the point where you are more or less permanently incarcerated or otherwise seriously handicapped, you can count yourself effectively out. It has been observed that the road to the palace leads through the dungeons, and Commander Rockwell changed that to read that the road to the White House leads through the jails. We also said that the object is to deliver our blows and yet avoid the jails at all costs. We've said that, in the event of an arrest, you shouldn't expect to be shown any mercy, and nor shall we show it on the day the tables are turned. We've seen cases which demonstrate that system persecution can and does make the sufferer stronger and sharper as a result. I've experienced it myself, where such things can provide the opportunity for new commitment and new beginning. We've said that, when it comes, it is your duty to take it like a man. The final thing to discuss on this matter is the personal decision of just what and how much is acceptable. Robert Miles, in his From the Mountain newsletter, advised never let them put you in their prisons. Prison is one of the hardest realities. When faced with the certainty or strong likelihood of going to prison, one of the most difficult decisions is whether to submit and hope you will come out alive and in one piece, or whether to resist, either by going completely underground or by dying in a final act of supreme defiance. These are the things each and every revolutionary must have already carefully sorted out in his mind well in advance of when such a situation may arrive. The cases of James Earl Ray and Joseph Paul Franklin are illustrative of what, to me, would be totally unacceptable. On the other hand, we see Rudolf Hess and Charles Manson bearing up quite well and admirably, as it is their belief that suicide under conditions of mere confinement is unmanly and dishonorable. Michael Perch and Fred Cowan chose death in their gunfights with police rather than a life and death in hellish prisons. One circumstance that does very definitely make the prospect of even minimal confinement appear outside the bounds of consideration is the thought of prison after having not struck a significant enough blow at the enemy first. In short, prison as a result of failure, as a result of inaction. I know I could not tolerate the idea for myself. The mark of a true revolutionary movement is that its members make their own choices as a matter of proper course, as duty and circumstances dictate. They avoid situations where their actions are governed by stimuli applied by the system, such as pressure and fear. Proper decisions are seldom made under such sudden and always inopportune constraints. The revolutionary moves first. Decide what your course shall be well in advance. Have your plan well laid so that the possibility of arrest, imprisonment, or untimely death may be reduced to a minimum. It is an inescapable reality that the underground must be built, the underground army, and, as any student of warfare knows, an army of volunteers far surpasses one of fugitives. As a sudden fugitive, your chances of successfully adjusting to and functioning within an underground environment are tremendously reduced. As a volunteer, you first prepare and then choose the time and place. In revolution, the price of failure generally is death. So whatever you do, and whatever course you choose, don't sell yourself cheap. Make it count. Volume 11, number 8, August 1982. 5.29, Retreat to Reality. The talk is big regarding a white readout in the U.S. Northwest, where it is said, even today, FBI, etc., don't care to venture. The reality of this is looming larger every day as things deteriorate, and even this quiet spot in Ohio begins to lose more and more credibility as a place to dig in and hang on while the storm rages overhead. I remind each of you what has been said before. Just because we may be part of a movement in opposition to all this insanity does not mean we are or shall be somehow magically immune to any of it when things break full force. It was also said that an organization which does not plan for its future isn't likely to have one. Those who want to live and possibly go on later to make a significant impact on the course of national and world affairs are going to have to strategically withdraw from grandiose designs of what might have been and surrender all illusions of what should be, for there is only what is, and that forever remains harsh reality. That was Volume 12, Number 1, January 1983. 5.30, Survival. In the past, I've spoken on the phoniness of these, quote, survivalist syndrome, as one of the latest right-wing escapist fads. But actual survival is no joke. Naked facts of life are taken into account when survival is spoken of in earnest. Where are you going to find food, water, shelter, heat, medicines, weapons, and ammunition in a world collapsed? If, for example, the trucking industry shuts down, for whatever reason, the cities will begin to starve within 2 weeks. And, for another example, should Big Brother's pigs be unable to control rioting and looting, that figure could drop to 2 days. Are you located in a city and dependent on centralized electricity, gas, and water? These things will be off the first few hours of a general collapse. When we spoke of real survival before, we began by saying that the city is no place to be, now and especially later. It's not getting any easier, even in these normal times, normal in quotes. Again, gradualism at work. Most evenings this time of year, one can watch on the news of how more and more laid-off working families and old people cannot afford to heat their homes. There are the, as yet, isolated cases of those freezing to death. What's the difference between a gradual emergency and a sudden one? Only that you are robbed of the chance to react appropriately and effectively. Meeting mortgages, rents, buying food, etc., it's the same now for most, a day-to-day struggle for existence. And how much more can the situation tolerate before it goes over the brink? Primary to survival, to my way of thinking, is that, at least out in the countryside, you stand a chance. Beyond that, it is up to you how well you prepare for the day when the point of no return is reached. And, as I said before, one of the things the movement has done a commendable job of has been making available a large amount of very good survival literature. Buy it, read it, use it. Volume 12, Number 1, January 1983. That was. 5.31, Before It's Too Late. No, this has nothing to do with the clock ticking out on the white race. This has to do with luck running out on each member of the movement individually. This hits home. How many of you have ever been arrested for anything? How many have had to fight lawsuits? How many have fought in the streets against the enemy? How many have been injured or jailed as a result? How many have gone without food or heat? How many have lived on the run? Or try something simple. How many have been personally smeared in the press? Given any one of these things, the average individual would break and run, would sell out his own grandmother in order to try and escape his own medicine. And, given any one of these things, if the consequences could not be avoided, the average individual would crack. The pig system knows this and depends upon it in its day-to-day workings. It could be said in complete truth that only swine could be ruled by a pig system. Members and adherents of the movement love to borrow from Nietzsche his famous passage, "That which does not destroy me only makes me stronger." The problem with that is that it is too big an if. The type of personal, one-on-one trial, the kind of sudden shock so well described by Commander Rockwell in This Time the World, 99% of the time does accomplish precisely what it is intended to do, utterly crush any resistance or opposition. These soft, flabby, outwardly and inwardly swine can't take it. Hell, they can't even take the thought of it. This is one of the few things that causes me worry. On me, they've tried everything except killing me, and so I stopped worrying about myself long ago. But I do worry about what might happen when and if one or a combination of the things I opened this segment with was tried against a broad enough section of the movement all at once. Certainly a separating of the wheat from the chaff would occur. But what happens if there are only a half dozen kernels of wheat left? I worry because I am certain that the movement in general isn't ready for precisely this very contingency. Would enough men be left after a sudden and hard system attack to be able to go on to form an effective underground to strike back? Because I am also certain that no real underground will be formed until after the system has struck. All I can say for myself is that I've been lucky. All my trials came one at a time, pretty evenly spaced out, and I was able, if sometimes only barely, to overcome each one of them and to gain strength and self-reliance from them. But I do worry about the rest. I've known and encountered so few really spit-in-the-eye types within our ranks that the thought of the after-effects of the shit hitting the fan scares me. And this could even take the form of a general system collapse instead of a system attack, which, as I've said in the past, would be as punishing on us as it would be on anybody else. Yet it is a collapse we must fight for and an attack that we must expect. To do less, to expect or desire less, is to be unreal. On the subject of unreality, it would be totally unreal for me to say something like, "We must have training for our people." Must is the most overworked word in the rightist vocabulary and is always, always the precursor to inaction. Inaction. To say we must means we haven't, and it means that, due to our sorrowfully factionalized Mickey Mouse state of organization, we don't have the capability. That's the reality of the situation. And so it will come down to tests of individuals. Judgment day, when each will stand or fall alone. Those left standing might be able to put something together. For the rest, their worries will be all over. This is what's known as doing it the hard way. Instead of taking advantage of the relatively calm times that now exist, for training and toughening. But, as Commander Rockwell said, a coward will keep on backing away from a fight until he is literally backed up to a wall or cliff. What then? And all I can say for the former days of the American Nazi Party, in opposition to those who think it was a, quote, waste of time, is that they provided some of the best experience and training possible for our field. We would sit around in those days during the 60s and laugh about how we would tell our grandchildren, quote, "I was a Nazi when it was hard to be a Nazi." Hardly. We were Nazis when it was easy to be Nazis, but because of that, we stand a better chance than most of living through the really hard times to come. To Commander Rockwell, I give a salute for his priceless leadership. To all newcomers, I say I'm sorry that Rockwell's successors did not strain every nerve, as he did, to keep the pressure up, even when it did appear futile to do so. To them, the best I can say is, jump in and start to swim hard now. If you wait until the ship sinks, you'll most likely drown. And that was Volume 12, Number 12, December 1983. Of Pigs and Professionals. Quote, "The only thing lower than niggers and Jews is police that protect them." Thus spoke Fred Cowan not long before he went out in his own blaze of glory, holed up in a building that was surrounded by police, come to the aid of some dead Negroes and a terrified Jewish boss who was hiding underneath a desk. His was a wry observation, a profoundly correct one, and one that will live throughout time, as long as this revolution lives and is remembered. We know how Commander Rockwell officially viewed police, with almost fawning worship and complete deference. This, on his part, was a monumental feat of revolutionary shrewdness and self-discipline. It was the correct stance for that time. But by the end of the 70s, it was clear, even to the most dense, that the usefulness of maintaining a friendly, benign stance toward professional law enforcement had been outlived. They, like the professional military, had their last chance to act and had blown it. Those who by then had not sold out had been edged out and silenced or otherwise compromised. All that was left were eager and willing professional pigs. He always capitalizes pigs. Ever notice how only a certain mentality becomes a cop or a professional soldier in these times? I've known several who did both. They might be compared to decadent Rome's Stoics were it not for their total lack of understanding or moral courage. They are gun fanatics, the law and order freaks, and they have trouble getting girls. They are the most dangerous and irredeemable reactionaries. They are the system's hired hoods, the system's pigs. And though the reactionary streak in them may at times cause them to sympathize with some of our program, they'll sell you out in a minute in the name of printed law. It is comparatively well known that the suicide rate among professional groups is highest among police. To be blunt, they are neurotic, cowardly, self-righteous bullies, and any comparison between them and the SS is enough to gag any real National Socialist, for these pigs are not in the least bit idealistic or devoted to any cause whatsoever, save enforcing the printed law as it is handed down by tyrannical judges and sold-out politicians. What else, how else can we regard them except as a major facet of the enemy? Conservatism and pigism are both the same, both enemies of revolution. Devoid of real ethics and motivation, the only two things keep the pigs in power in this land: the mood and atmosphere set by the superabundance of the, quote, Uncle Toms I mentioned before, and the continued existence of the economy. Despite any 21st century line of electronic surveillance systems, the pigs could not function, minus their finks, their informants. And were it not for the government's continued ability to pay them their wages, handed over by sheepish herds of tax-paying consumers, they'd quickly get out and take jobs better suited to them, like pumping gas or some other honest labor. We can start to defeat them now, individually, simply by being superior. Step one is to stop imagining that they have eyes in the back of their heads, or that they are all-seeing in any way. They are not, as long as we stay away from stupid conspiracies and other compromising situations, and even more stupid talk. Step two is to learn their silly little routine games which they play on every suspect, and know how to rebuff these at the time they are attempted. That is 90% of any encounter with the police. Third is to discipline ourselves to stand firm against them, even in the face of total personal disaster, so that we ourselves, and the revolution as a whole, will not be further weakened or discredited. Their power will gradually be overturned and destroyed through the increased lack of faith and interest on the part of the public, as well as our own rock-solid opposition. Offensive tactics against them are entirely unwarranted and unnecessary now and for long into the future. Once under serious attack by them, of course consider yourself a marked individual and proceed to kill as many of them as you can. Volume 13, Number 4, April 1984. 5.33, "The pigs are your friends," unquote. If there's trouble, call a cop. If you believe that, please stay away from me. That is a mentality that has to be stamped out. I realize that an entire segment of the population will probably have to be stamped out along with it, but nonetheless, the artificially created instinct to rely on police whenever extraordinary circumstances arise has made way for the Uncle Tom syndrome I have mentioned often in the past. Indeed, without this reliance upon a paid army in blue to handle your violent, extra-legal situations for you, no such, quote, Uncle Tom syndrome could have arisen at all. To the average person, the cop is Big Brother. The natural thing for them to do when the threat of trouble appears, or is even hinted at, is to go running to the pigs with the story. Pigs may be pigs, but those who have truck with them are indeed swine. What's been cultivated over the past century or so in this country has been generation after generation of more or less adult children. Boy, is that true. Those who can perform certain jobs they are trained to do and generally live within the master's rules, but who cannot truly fend for themselves when it comes right down to jungle basics, the law of nature. Anyone steps out of line and it's call the police. Let the police handle it. And, on the opposite hand, they know that should they ever step out of line themselves, they will have to deal with the police. That is the outermost limit of their existence, their thought, and their world. It never occurs to them, what if the police are no more than tools of an evil, corrupt regime? Even among children, however, is the lingering animal, true, instinct that where there are police, there is trouble. People are nervous within the sight of cops, whether on the street or on the road. That's the reason for all the PR and such slogans as, "The police are your friends." It works up to a point, but within that lies all that is necessary to make their rule complete. They may not have warmth and affection, but they've got fear and respect. When it comes right down to it, results are all that count, and the result of all this has been that we have a Big Brother police state. Looking at it from an objective standpoint, and assuming for the moment their only job is to fight crime, let's take in the facts. In the big cities, we might even pity them for the spot they're in. They are fighting hard, but they are fighting a losing battle. Mainly, they fight to hold their jobs and for the sake of appearances. Make no mistake, crime rules. In the smaller towns, like this one, they are good for two things: hassling young punks and busting old drunks. The unsolved murders and unreported, that is, reported but not released by the press, rapes are a bad joke. If you're assaulted or burglarized or vandalized, you're out of luck. Out of luck, that is, if you depend on the police and are willing to let it go at that. It is accepted that if you are robbed, you can forget ever recovering any of your property, even assuming the culprits are apprehended. The tale, ridiculous but true, about handling it yourself and then calling the police, getting you into bigger trouble than the crooks, is reality. In one or two times that people, unaware of the aura that surrounds this place, have tried to make my home and those who live in it victims of their crime, it has been handled strictly in a free enterprise fashion, but with this revolutionary difference. Police were never called at any point, before or after. We live safe, and we live free. Not only that, the whole valley here enjoys it as well. Perhaps not everyone can handle it themselves. They, by definition, are dependent upon others for their lives, not an enviable position. And dependent upon whom? Around here, it is commonly accepted that if you need a cop, call the nearest donut shop. It is a travesty that children and the elderly are thus, quote, protected in a land where the worst savages ever to existed anywhere in history roam at large as, quote, citizens, subsidized by the system. But if police are not worth much of a damn at doing the job they're supposed to do, what in the hell is it that keeps them busy, and what are they really intended for? Simply, they are Big Brother's first line of defense. Where the conditioning and the brainwash may fail, where the dope, the sex, the thrills fall short, where the monetary terrorism proves ineffectual, and the person may step outside the master's rules, that is where the true role of police becomes clear and obvious. Crime is universal. It is everywhere. It is even accepted as a way of life. Revolution, bucking the master's rules, however, is not. It is an impossible task within a, quote, civilized context to fight crime in this country, things having gone as far as they have. Besides, the criminal element serves a definite purpose in Big Brother's plan, a purpose that we've discussed previously in Siege. The police are really there to step in when the truly extraordinary happens. And what is that, other than any act of revolution? Any act of, quote, civil disobedience? Volume 13, April 1984. Finally, the last segment of the chapter in this recording is 5.34, Learning Not to Fuck Up. It may be construed as paranoid to come out and say that the police are only there to mess you up. If you exist as a truly, quote, herd animal, you might never experience any difficulty with them at all. You might live out your existence in total indifference. But even those types live with the ever-present risk that someday, somehow, a Big Brother minion might decide it's time to cut one out of the herd for an impromptu slaughter. Maybe a la Amazon River, where one is sacrificed to the voracious piranha. That is no existence for a real white man. Those who decide not to follow master's rules will have to get sharp, physically and mentally, if they are going to long survive, for sooner or later. Big Brother will, for sooner or later, Big Brother will fix his sights on you. Brushes and run-ins with the police do not have to end in disaster for the cause and victory for the system. You must fully expect to have these brushes, often, and you must be prepared to handle them. You can either live for the cause and fight for the cause in a totally legalistic way, and, when you must face the police, you can do so with a complete knowledge that you are perfectly clean. Or, you can choose to become part of the lawless breed and learn to become an Academy Award-winning actor. My own personal set of morals, at least those few morals that I have fixed and permanent, will not allow me to advocate in a general way that anyone go the route of complete lawlessness. I don't want to see anyone victimized, and I refuse to have a hand in their victimization. As was said in a previous segment, I consider myself among the luckiest individuals on earth for having bucked so many odds successfully for so long. Like the Vikings, I hold luck as something very real and sacred, almost as a science. Never abuse it, or it will destroy you. When, through your righteous actions, your bold and daring tactics, your chivalrous demeanor, etc., luck chooses to smile on you, then you must do your part by learning and profiting thus by each and every experience so that Lady Luck won't have to carry quite such a share of the burden next time. Instead of a dependent of luck, you'll become a partner. Part of mastering self-discipline is the ability to know, in advance, what is stupid and what is not, so as to be able to avoid doing anything stupid yourself. It is stupid, by the way, to fall to pieces when run up against adversity, large or small. I do not advocate this lifestyle for all, because I know, I have experienced, how most can and will fall apart under a certain amount of stress. A ridiculously low amount, I might add. As kids, my gang and I used to get into all kinds of kid-style trouble. Some would crack the moment it appeared the jig was up. Others would crack wide open merely at the passage of time, even when nothing occurred and it would have seemed that we were absolutely in the clear. Some could be tricked, others could be scared. I must credit myself that, even as a child, I had pretty good composure. I wasn't an incorrigible, as that, in this context, describes a typical punk. Let us say that I was damn skillful and seldom caught. And when caught, I had the art of the next step, a possibly even more important step, cutting your losses. You will be caught. Remember this, for it is a fact. Anyone who isn't a complete fool can expect to get away with some things for a while without getting caught. It's an old story. They will keep it up and up until they overextend, develop a pattern, or otherwise trip themselves up. Down swoops the system, and personal disaster usually follows. As a kid, the rat may have been small, but as a revolutionary, the cost is life and or liberty. You had better know how to cut your losses. Had Nixon known this, you'd never have heard of Watergate. You must expect to be caught. This is a struggle against an enemy who is in power everywhere, and you are an outlaw. No one's skill and no one's luck can be expected to hold forever in every case. Mine certainly hasn't. Yet I suppose one can look upon the ability to cut one's losses as the ability to end game one and begin game two in order to gain one's own advantage. That takes skill and luck and judgment all by itself. It is this realization, when constantly borne in mind, that will lead you to exert extreme caution even while in the midst of what others surely would call the most daring and foolhardy of exploits. If you're not caught in the act of something, then you generally will have great room to maneuver later on, should anyone pick up your trail. It is here where you'll have to prove your gamesmanship, because it will be a game in which the only real permanent loser can be you. When the term pig is used, it applies not only to police, but to any person or agency of authority within the system. And the term, quote, crime is the only blurb you can expect when it comes time for you to feel their inquisition. It applies to any act, large or small, violent or white collar, which goes outside the rules. So much can be summed up in so few words and basic principles. Quote, deprogramming what the system has taught us, what the system has taught, is where most difficulty is encountered. Deprogramming what the system has taught is where most difficulty is encountered. Taking control over one's thoughts, reactions, and emotions makes up all of the rest. Beyond that, the rule must always be to always act alone or in the smallest numbers possible. Next is to never talk, before, during, or after. And after means forever after. Next is to leave no witnesses and no evidence to turn up later on. All of these precautions may be taken, and still, eventually, you will be before detectives or panels of investigation. You will be either under suspicion or under arrest, eventually. Knowing or having a pretty good idea of the strength of the pig's case against you is of critical importance, and you can only really know this through knowing yourself and being aware of all your actions. Never forget the unbelievable number of those who are completely innocent, but are broken and railroaded by professional techniques of investigation, intimidation, interrogation, and perhaps most dangerous of all, entrapment. Bluff, high pressure, and surely by the pigs are your friends, let us help you, and so forth. That is tough enough. But going in to face an interrogation, a most dangerous and uncomfortable experience, I assure you, under any circumstances, when you yourself know you are guilty of what they are investigating or accusing you of, is something else entirely. Here is where it either all comes together or falls apart. I don't recommend trying this unless you know what you are doing. The word here is brinksmanship. You must know how much to admit, what to deny, where to be vague. You'll be asked to write your story out for comparison later on. You'll be asked to submit to polygraph examination. You'll be told you're sunk already. You'll be insulted and threatened. You'll be alone and surrounded by a room full of pigs. Sometimes it will happen that friends, acquaintances, even family may have actually betrayed you. Scenarios of your life ending may pass before your eyes. Through it all, your composure must never slip for even a split second. At this precise moment, things are most critical. It'll be the longest hour of your life, and you'll probably be able to count on a good many of them. But if you can withstand the best that the police academy can dish out in that initial blitz, then you most likely have weathered the storm. A long war of nerves is far preferable to a short war of violence. If you walk away from that encounter a free man, then, most usually, the thing is reduced to a kind of sick, graveside game of Mickey Mouse. This is the contest. The sight of a blubbering weakling, shaking, crying, babbling like an asshole is no contest at all. One of the primary things to always keep in mind is that police have no magical powers. Police have no magical powers. They are not omniscient. They depend on your foolishness and the cooperation of others, informants, to win their battles. if you rob them of these by not making typical idiotic mistakes and by not exposing yourself to needless vulnerability and betrayal, then you are entitled to march into their lair like the Lord of the Earth and proceed to match wits with half-wits. The sensation of fear will never leave you, nor should it. It is there to help you. It, not they, is your friend. Your fear is your friend, not them who are saying they're your friends, the cops. The fear will do the most to keep you sharp and on your toes, alert and super aware of what's around you. Tempered by the highest degree of self-control and self-discipline, fear will help make you a formidable beast of prey. Perhaps the only appropriate bottom line to this was supplied by one who provided little else in his career with the movement other than this comment, which I'll paraphrase here. Quote, "When it comes time for you to finally cash in your chips, you'll go out with a deep sense of satisfaction for having always kept one up on the forces of the pig system." Close quote. Keep it that way. Live it that way. And that was volume 13, number 4, April 1984. And that concludes section 5 on the system. Thanks for being with me today. And I'll be back with you soon again with some more from James Mason's Siege.